So, I guess I can get started because I have some poems to read and some things to read. So, welcome. Hello, everyone. Do we have anyone here who wasn't here yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Quite a few people. So, just so you know, this PowerPoint is all one PowerPoint. So, all of the days are in one PowerPoint presentation that you have access to. Where we have a sign-up sheet for email, so don't worry about writing down everything you see. You will have this PowerPoint. So that's the first thing. I encourage you to write down what you are feeling, what is not on the PowerPoint, conversations that come up for you. Whatever comes up for you, that's what I want you to write down. Secondly, either on here or through questions and answering, we're trying to keep track of what book titles we bring up so we can have a book list for you also at the end of the week. Take those down just in case I forget. But we will plan on having a book list related to this class at the end of the week. And I am going to review yesterday's session before we get started. But because it's a class on theopoetics, I'm going to start by reading some poems and also some words of Bruno Malves, who is a Brazilian theologian that is one of the fathers of theopoetics. What we'll learn today in terms of, as it relates to a little bit of methodology and what theopoetics is, really relates to these poems. So, Mike, thank you for these.
You're welcome.
Mike came up to me this morning and said, could you write your name down and three words? And I said, sure, I'll play the script. And so I wrote down my name and I, should I tell them the words or should I not tell them the words?
It's up to you. It's completely you. Although I do have publishing rights if I ever publish something.
Well, fine. But I'm just going to read these. But, the three words were daybreak, intuition, and sprawl.
Mm.
And I'm going to start this class by reading these poems because they're so good. Number one. My cat likes to sprawl with her back against the wall from daybreak until the tall clock strikes noon. And then she moves into the kitchen through lunch and dinner, and the pale light of the moon comes. Through the window pane, every day I watch her play this... This insane scenario, and I think I know why her intuition tells her it is safe and secure, and that it is the only allure to why she stays at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, the second poem. Daybreak comes, but it is not the last or the least that will be broken. She works in the field until the token amount of energy she has gets her to her bunk to sprawl. She has given her all and will be required to do it again on the morrow. She dreams of escape, of freedom, of toil and torture and rape. But her tuition tells her the only freedom she will know is in her dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Mike. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read an excerpt from the word, I always do that, the poet, the warrior, and the prophet, which is one of the seminal texts from Rubem Alves, just to get a little bit of a sense of how he interweaves notions of scripture and poetry in life. It says, now for a moment let us play with our imagination. Imagination is the realm where thought is omnipotent and everything is possible. Let us imagine the impossible. A nightmare, a strange dinner, sheer nonsense. All the rules of reality turned upside down. The lobsters are alive and so the fishes, the shrimps, the oysters, the fowl. The vegetables have knives and forks in their hands, and they're all sitting at the table ready to begin eating the dinner. The hostess, a plumpy onion, orders the maid to bring in the entree, and there they are, just out of the oven, ready to be eaten. And right when the lobster is about to grab your nose with her claws, we wake up in terror. Nonsense, we say with a sigh of relief. Don't be too sure. Dreams contain revelations of repressed truth which can only appear under the mask of nonsense. It is in the nonsense the psychoanalyst looks for truth, and the gospel, wisdom in foolishness. Nonsense reflects in the split second the coherence of the universal mystery which surrounds and creates us. The reality which we familiarly know says, we eat the food, we assimilate the food becomes what we are. But suddenly a new truth is heard, when the etiquette is subverted and the world is turned upside down. We are eaten by the food assimilates us, we become what we eat. The hostess offers me wine. The liquid is tame and innocent, well-behaved in the glass. I take one sip, two. I empty the glass. It is pleasant. The liquid is being assimilated into my body, which feels the joy of the lightness of being. The world remains the same, with just an extra drop of pleasure added to it. But then, in a subtle moment, a reversal occurs. I no longer drink the wine. It is the wine which drinks me. I have been drunk by it. Mm. I am drunk. Mm. Now it is not the wine which enters my body. It is the wine which holds me inside a glass and drinks me, and I enter into a totally different world, a strange world which I don't know. My body is possessed by spirits which have remained outside till that moment. In vino veritas, in wine truth abides. Pentecost. They were filled with the Spirit. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the second class of Theopoetics. Today we are going to do a little work in thinking through what Theopoetics actually is. I mean, such an endeavor. But before we do that, we're going to do a little bit of a review. So yesterday we learned about the historical context of Theopoetics. Theopoetics was influenced by three main events. The Society for Arts, Religion, and Contemporary Culture, which is a nonprofit started by the likes of Paul Tillich, Alfred Barr, who was the first director of Modern Museum of Art in New York, and several other people. Secondly, by the consultations of hermeneutics at Drew University. Hermeneutics is a study of interpretation, so they were digging into how can we have language and talk about God through our experience. And finally, the Death of God movement. What do we do now that God is dead and the church is on the outs? These are the contexts that Theopoetics is birthed in. Secondly, Theopoetic scholars came from various fields, yet all agreed on the role of the imagination and arts as central to understanding God. And finally, each of these areas represent a need to understand God in a new way, to move from rigid logical systems to one where imagination and the arts are centered. That's a little bit of kind of what we talked about yesterday, just to give us some context. And today we're going to go into the definition of Theopoetics. So this initial definition comes from ARC, Arts, Religion, and Culture, which is the current or contemporary iteration of the older nonprofit SARC. So the nickname for SARC has always been ARC, and we just use that name because it's easier for people to say, honestly. But they say, Theopoetics is an emphasis, a style, and a positive concern from the intersection of religious reflection and spirituality with the imagination, aesthetics, and the arts, especially as it takes shape in ways that grows community, focuses on material change, and affirms the importance of embodiment. Mm-hmm. They continue, and this is what we talked about a little yesterday as well. More generally, Theopoetics is not an alternative to theology. It is a way to do religious reflection that gives greater attention to form, genre, and method. It validates art, experience, and the body as a source of religious reflection, and is concerned with the emotional and pre-rational impact, as well as the concrete consequences of religious reflection. Basically, art and ideas should matter. So, when we're thinking about the context of it not being theology, or not being a separate theology, it's basically asking the question that if you consider art, theology, embodiment, right, consequences of our religious reflections, notions of centering community, when you center these ideas, what about the way we do theology, right, changes? And how do we live into that change? So what we're going to do today is I'm going to go through some definitions by some of my friends and who are also Theopoets and who have been thinking about this for a while. What you will notice is Theopoets, besides that definition I just read you, there is no true central definition for the term. And the reason for that is because people have entered into the conversation from various different avenues and experiences. So while there is the historical notion that we learned about yesterday, we also talked about notions about contemporary theopoets, particularly those of color, who have been operating in these spaces of contextual, creative practices, embodiment, justice, that they didn't register as a theopoetic. And so what's happening now is a lot of those people who have had those experiences, you know, have been doing that work, are now moving into the area of theopoetics because it resonates with what they were already doing. And so you'll get a little insight sense in how that is working in their respective areas. So the first, I wanted to start off with a definition from Callot Keith Perry, which is in the book Way to Water, which is kind of like the main text of this course. Theopoetics is an acceptance of cognitive uncertainty regarding the divine, an unwillingness, this is important, to attempt to unduly banish that uncertainty, and an emphasis on action and creative articulation regardless. So this is really about this uncertainty regarding the divine. There is an acceptance of it. There is an unwillingness to banish it. And there is an infinite emphasis on action and creative articulation, regardless of what we find, right? Changes the game as we think about theology, because theology is how do we move into a more and more precise knowing about who God is. You know, I practice how to say that word. Huh? Who said that? I think it's like Nwatol. Okay, thank you. Okay, Patrick Reyes, theopoet and author of books The Purpose Gap and Nobody Cries When We Die. I don't know if The Purpose Gap is in our library, but I know someone found Nobody Cries When We Die in the Holden Library. So you may want to check the library for some of these theopoetic books. They may be there. I've only looked at the religious section, so I'm not religious, the fiction section, so I don't know what else is in the library. So he says, based on the Nahual definition of the divine and the role poetic plays in the Mexican community to reflect theologically, I define theopoetics as the creative language of a community and its members to express what is above and what is beyond. This means, faculty, my apologies, this means that theopoetics is a practice of making word about God or gods, tracking the spirit of the community and building theological models to wrestle with the day-to-day struggle of the community. So you'll notice that he first situates his definition of theopoetics in the community that he is from and in the community that he is committed to, first and foremost. And then he continues to center it around the community, how the community understands the creative language of the beyond, how the community continues to build and follow in the spirit, how it relates to the day-to-day struggles of the community. So community is really important in the way in which Reyes enacts his theopoetic worldview. Kate Common, rather than focusing on a specific marginalized community, theopoetics discourse focuses on a marginalized epistemology, the poetic. While other liberation theologies point to this epistemological marginalization, theopoetics is built around it. Its focus of energy around the singular topic is important because it illuminates the inherent blind spots of rational-only discourse. As a feminist theologian and professional artist, it is not enough for me to say that women and other marginalized voices have been silenced and oppressed in our current global imperial system. I must also insist that poetic practices and ways of knowing have also been silenced. Theopoetics is a discourse that helps me to do this by connecting me to other conversations specifically dealing with this topic. And so what Kate Common does, it's a notion of not just marginalized people groups, but marginalized epistemologies or ways of knowing. The poetic as opposed to the rational, right? The poetic as opposed to the logical. So we talked yesterday about hierarchies, and we talked about yesterday about marginalization. The ways in which we interact with God have been marginalized as they relate to the theopoetic. And so theopoetics doesn't say that we're going to get rid of theology. Theopoetics reminds us that there are more than one way to interact, to talk about, and to connect to God. Finally, James Howard Hill. James Howard Hill is a really good friend of mine, and is doing some really incredible work looking at Black theologies and the aesthetic and theopoetic trajectories of Michael Jackson. He could talk to you for hours about super fascinating things. He said, "Would I use the term theopoetics to describe the Black Christian experience in America? I am referring to the ability of Black religious communities to imaginatively express their faith convictions through art, song, poetry, oral witness, and other embodied practices. Key to understanding the rich theopoetical tradition of Black religious communities is the manner in which their theopoetic practices were used to inaugurate alternative worlds." That's important. I'll say that again. "Key to understanding the rich theopoetical tradition of Black religious communities is the manner in which their theopoetic practices were used to inaugurate alternative worlds of anti-colonial sociopolitical possibility, worlds that were often sequestered from them by the neo-corporal political forces surrounding them. Through their songs, tears, and collective imagination, the Black citizens of Marion and Selma provided Americans with an ample opportunity to beat their swords into plowshares and their theological textbooks into freedom songs, and perhaps, for the first time ever, to play the tunes written in their collective collection." And so, as we begin to think about the ways in which the Black community not only offers a focus on community, right, that Reyes talks about, a focus on epistemology that Commons talks about, into the situation of justice-oriented and in the face of anti-colonial socio-political worlds and possibilities, right? The African-American creative and embodied context moves us into new worlds and gives us opportunities to begin to shift, right, into the kinds of practices and ways of knowing that those worlds represent. So that is, you know, the plowshares, right? The freedom songs, the tunes written of our collective flesh. Those are practices of new worlds, right? And inhabiting and enter into those new worlds and operating within them is in and of itself its own resistance of the worlds that try to dominate, that try to oppress, that try to marginalize. And so theopoetics then becomes a gateway, right? A gateway of practice, a gateway of epistemology, so that we're not just talking about new worlds, we're not just talking about dismantling, but we're actually building on new worlds, we're creating avenues, and we're operating as if those worlds already exist. So this is a prolepsis, right? The now and the not yet, right? The little sense of like what we see, like what is to come. This is that moment, right? And so we say, how do we adapt and turn our practices to those kinds of worlds so that it in and of itself moves us into it? Yeah. So I have a working definition. It's not as poetic as the other one, so I figure you all can help me, you know, figure this out. So basically, at its core, theopoetics is the creative embodied practices and rhythms that help us articulate sensibilities about the divine, right? That's all we really have, are sensibilities. Used in theological discourse, theopoetics becomes a modifier and a mode, helping us to correct ways where theology becomes an idol of intellectual enterprise, right? Deployed to have its Burgeon cadence, and a recentering of artistic and embodied ways of knowing that lead to a deeper understanding of our role on the path toward collective liberation. Questions? Because I'm gonna put you to work now. Questions? Comments? Yes.
I love how your definition of theopoetics uses theopoetics in the definition to have birds in cages, right?
Yeah. And that is the notion of birds and words in cages, that is from Alves. That is an image that he invokes about, when he talks about certain theological enterprises. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I like how it has the word idol, or thinking of theology as an idol, because it just, for so many people, theology is everything. The only way.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it's just interesting because in a lot of theologies, I think they are trying to like pose the question of, is the Bible an idol?
Yeah.
So to pose the question of, is theology itself an idol, is so like, it opens so many doors.
Yeah, and I think it is. I was I don't know why I like messing with students so much. It's probably why I shouldn't teach. But I love messing with my students. And so in some of our classes, we have, you know, people who will talk about theology and like, defend it to the death. Or they'll talk about the Bible and they'll defend it to the death. And I was like, you know, theology is not God.
Mm.
And hold your horses. Are you sitting down? The Bible is not God. And they say, well, the word, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, the beginning was the word. And the word became flesh. So technically, the only word that is God would probably be Jesus. And Jesus isn't the Bible.
Mm.
So therefore, the Bible isn't God.
Mm.
And I think that when we... How can I say this? Symbols have power.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Icons have power, right? This is why we have certain rituals. This is why we pray to certain things, right? This is why people pray to Mary and to all these different things. This is a lot of... what, you know, has been said in the last week, especially with our art presentations, right, about symbols and art and images, all of these things have power. The problem is what happens when we now take those symbols, those icons, those things, and we make them the definitive power instead of the gateway to the world of what they represent. And so I think that theology has always been... First, I'll say theology is a semiotic system. Theology is a system of symbols in which we have created to help understand and articulate things mm-hmm. about God.
Right.
End of story. Mm-hmm. Right? I'll talk about on Friday how I think theology, honestly, is speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Nobody wants to hear that. Technically, it's true. Because of that, what we tend to do is because the thing is something that is tangible, it's something that has certain boundaries. It is something that is, in some ways, understandable. We feel a sense of control or calm in a thing that we can touch, see, engage with our senses and our minds. And so then we begin to give back the soul power because what lies behind it is outside of our control, right? So that is scary. That requires something of us that we do not know how to articulate yet. And not everybody is ready to take that step. And so it is easier then to give the soul power to the thing as opposed to the thing that it represents. And so in a lot of ways, I think that theology has become that thing for people, right? Certain systems and rituals within denominations have become that thing for people. This is why when you have questions about how should we do this within liturgy or what should we do for this as a community, and people are like, this is the way it's always been done, right? It has nothing to do with theological engagement of like where we are, you know, in our theology and how we under understanding God in this moment. This is the way things have been done. This is the ritual that makes me feel safe. This is the thing that has power for me, right? And so then change becomes either really difficult or inevitable because it is only under the guidelines or the boundaries of the thing. And I think that is what theology has become for people.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think theopoetics is important because it is not about erasing lines altogether, right? Like it's just a blob of nothingness. But it is about saying that these lines are not stagnant, they're dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And so they move, and so we should move along with them, mm-hmm. right? And some of the places that we will move, we will not have a name for yet. And that's okay. And so it creates a different kind of rhythm and positionality toward the idea of God, right? It always reminds us that the thing isn't God, but God is God, right? Yes.
Do you worry about theopoetics becoming an idol, or not really?
Yeah. Right. You got to worry about everything becoming an idol. Every metaphor breaks down at some point. I do this with friends, like, let's create a metaphor out of something, and I'm like, oh, it can be used like this, we can use it like this, and then it breaks down, because you're like, well, technically, if this thing is this, then in this context it won't work, because blah, blah, blah. You always have that one nay in the back, right? Every metaphor breaks down. And so at a certain point, the idea about theopoetics in its iteration right now will break down. Even when this first came out as a field in academia in the 60s, it died out in the 70s and 80s, because they didn't think they needed it anymore. Mm. Then new professors came, and they were like, and then all the stuff happened in the 90s, and they're like, we need something different, and theopoetics resurged. So I think that, yes, it can become an idol if we forget what it's doing. Mm. Yes?
You made me think about a couple of things, and one is that theopoetic approach could be really significant in faith community formation or renewal. So if congregations actually were to imaginatively express, especially the definition you gave us, I think just before this one, but imaginatively express their longings and yearnings and notions and sensibilities about God together. That would be such an amazing means of renewal of a sense of community. Mm-hmm. Then I was also thinking about a piece of art that was done for Holden, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, but it was created by the artist, but through community interaction. So mm-hmm. she worked for a year, it's a tree of life, but she worked for a year sketching and painting, and then people came together to comment. What should this be? It was to express a theme for the year, and how they worked together to express their theological questioning and sensibilities and hungers through one person's painting.
Right.
And it struck me that that was theopoetics.
It was, and the role of the artist wasn't, in what I hear you say, the role of the artist wasn't hierarchical. Right?
Yes. No. Yeah.
It was very much a give and a take. It was very reciprocal, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that, as a practice, mm-hmm. is important. Mm-hmm. Where did Laura go? Laura, we were talking about this at coffee hour, about the ways in which you walk into a space and the church has already told you theologically what they believe, mm-hmm. right? Why is this here?
Oh, the firing?
Yeah, the firing in the center of the room was the thing. Like, if this was a worship space, this would tell me something theologically about what the people in this community believe, right? Who stands in the front? How the chairs are positioned, right? If there's a huge, ginormous table that says, do this in remembrance of me, right? There's a baptism. So all of these senses of positioning and all of the things that we think, like, we may be just decorating or it's just functional, says something theologically. Mm. And so the ways that we can begin to think about what the things are for, like all of these things are tools, right, for us to help us, again, articulate sensibilities about God. And so if we understand them as such and the power that they have, then we know how to both utilize them and also to not fall into the worshiping of those things. Let's go to Maria because she has to say something, and then Mike. Yes.
So that being so, then the poetics of life become integrated into our theology, and
yes.
So it becomes an integration of an embodied way of thinking about God and reflecting on our life as humans and also of the divine
mm-hmm.
through
yes.
our daily practices.
Yes, and that's why epistemologies, that's why acknowledging the marginalization of those ways of knowing is important. Because when we don't do that, and we rightly, right, acknowledge all of the peoples who have been marginalized, but we don't acknowledge the ways that they know they have been marginalized, we get the space where you're trying to bring artists into a church context, but you want them to think and do just like you do, because the only thing that you think has been marginalized is the person or the location. And not the epistemology, not the daily practices that they bring. right? I always tell people, artists bring more than just what they do. They bring a perspective, right? They bring an embodied way of knowing. They remind you that there are more ways that you can know, right? There are more ways that you can live into the world. And if we are only thinking about them as people in vocations, right, or as task workers to make everything look pretty, then we will miss that knowingness. Not only will we miss it in them, right, but we will miss it for ourselves. So yes, that's very important. I'm going to go to Mike, and then I'm going to go to, what is your name?
Carol.
Okay. Do you see it being used in other discourses or disciplines? I mean, we talked about theology, kind of archaeology, but engineering, mathematics, things like that, physics, is
you know,
a possibility?
That's really interesting. We talked a little bit yesterday about failure and talked about how we actually need to learn from the scientists, because scientists fail marvelously. Then they write articles about it, and then they stake a whole career, and that one time they fail, and what they learn from that failure. So I think that it's present. I think that there's always this reciprocity of learning that can occur within disciplines, right?
Can I say something to that?
Yeah.
And that if so tomorrow my talk are artists who are doing social practices, and so if artists are taking on a specific discourse, they have to invite other discourses in, so they might have to bring in engineering or science or social human services. And so then, yes, it does become cross-disciplinary, where they're inviting other perspectives into the Theo conversation.
Yeah, and so to reiterate that for the recording, Maria, we'll talk about this tomorrow, utilizes this very interdisciplinary conversation and modalities that you're talking about, Mike, for artists to be able to think and work through their own work. You can't do it without this embodied sense of reciprocity in these conversations and these other ways of knowing. You can't do it unless it's interdisciplinary, which is why you will get, you know, we've had at the conference that I'm going to talk about tomorrow, we've had people who have come who are engineers or who were, you know, who just kind of had a love and affinity for the arts, and they also were a person of faith, but they weren't an artist or a pastor, but they were interested. And they found a space to be able to kind of work that through and then to enter into the conversation from their world, right? From their way of doing, their discipline. So there's room. There's definite room for us to learn. I think, though, I can't say it will be easier for them to learn, but I think that I will say, especially for Christian churches and Christians who are not already lean and tapped into theopoetic ways of knowing, it will be more difficult for them to learn because of the nature of, we have the ultimate truth. So when you operate out of that space in a really rigid way, can't nobody tell you nothing, right? And you will either reject it or you will over-spiritualize it to the point to where it loses its essence. And so a theopoetic understanding holds that balance, right? The balance of the knowing in the world that you are bringing, right? That meets in mutual learning, that meets in the conversation with the world that you are entering, right? There is always this knowing and this holding, but not this sense of so dominating or colonializing. Carol.
Yeah, thanks. You briefly mentioned the word liturgy, and before you mentioned that, I was going to ask you this question. And this just seems, a couple of us were talking last night, it seems so, I think, so relevant to the, the rituals that we use, in worship, and, mm-hmm. and you know, the failure to take this kind of approach. I think partly why people don't go to church. I think for me, when I was trying to last night describe what's missing for me, it's like, yes. So is there somebody working especially in that area of how we reimagine, rituals in worshiping communities with this kind of perspective?
Yes. We also had a long conversation about that at coffee hour. Tomorrow we'll talk about a couple of projects and things on the ground that are case studies of theopoetics, one of which will be the Subversive Liturgy Project.
Oh, okay.
The first, just as a plug for tomorrow, I guess. The Subversive Liturgy Project is a project that was started in Pasadena, California, the fall of 2016 after an officer-involved killing of J.R. Thomas. And what started as a quest to bring the grief of a community to the steps of power, of sitting out a memorial for him at the public entrance of the Pasadena police station, turned into a year-long weekly liturgical service.
Okay.
At the Pasadena police station. And we're going to talk a little bit about kind of some of the things we did there and what came out of that. There was a lot of different responses that came out of that project. So that's one way. The organization, the Kinship Commons, the business that we're starting, which is an LLC, think of like CCLI, so like licensing, getting music and things that you can only do for your churches. But we're building out a database that is for people of color, by people of color, that will include song, poems, prayers, and subscription-based so people can have access to resources. So that would be another example. Mm-hmm. I think there are people in our community who are creating incredible liturgical services that are deeply theopoetic. One of which is one of my coworkers at Kinship, Julie Kai, who is also the director of chapel at Fuller Seminary. The depth of their ability to creatively and so thoughtfully bring a community into different spaces with God is unparalleled. Just a couple of the services. One of my favorite services was a service that was a blues service. So it was just all blues music. And an incredible sermon by an Old Testament scholar who is now in Chicago. Another one was one that focused on immigration and was done outside with a very large fence constructed. And half of the congregation for the day was on one side of the fence, and the other half was on the other side of the fence, and they did the whole service looking at each other through the fence, right? And so these deeply thoughtful, like out-of-the-box interactions about what does it mean for us to really experience and know, right, our role as Christian community, what it is that we're facing. There's some really incredible, incredible stuff being done.
I'm aware on my own, a lot of us were doing these things that were part of, you know, social justice movements, peace movement, you know, in our actions, and especially when we did it as faith-based folks, whether, you know, we're, you know, sitting in on the tracks, blocking, you know, trains of, you know, destruction, or that we didn't have language to, how that related to, I'm just mindful of having done some of those kind of things, but I had never heard any word theopoetics or understood it in this kind of way. So
and so many people, that's how they enter into the conversation, not because they're like, you know, I found this history book on no, because it's like, here's a word that encapsulates and articulates what I've been feeling and doing, and this is a way for me to find like-minded people who can also have this I don't have to translate for them. I don't have to try to explain. Like, I can just enter in and be who I am and have the sensibilities that I do and have conversation with. And so, like, a lot of the people that you'll encounter at a gathering will be like-minded people who said, oh, you know, I've been doing this for years, or I've been engaging in this, and when I saw the term theopoetics, everything just clicked.
Right.
And it was like, that's me. There's something else I was going to say. And it's gone. Yes?
When you talk about the gathering, could you remind us what the body is that's gathered in case we want to, like, is it the heart or whatever? And then secondly, I wanted to ask you, if you might tell us a little about the organization that you're the executive director of, if it has to do with theopoetics.
Yes and yes. So the Gathering, the Theopoetic Conference, is hosted by the organization that I'm the executive director of, and we will actually talk about that conference tomorrow.
Okay.
That's one of the case studies.
Okay.
The SARC, the Society of Arts, Religion, and Contemporary Culture.
No, the ARC.
Yes, they're the same.
Okay.
They're the same organization historically.
Okay.
The reason that they use the ARC term is it has gone through all different iterations. Around 2017, Caleb Keith Perry, who wrote Way to Water, he had, you know, established a website called theopoetics.net where he was gathering all this information about theopoetics, mostly for himself. But then he started to realize that all these people were coming to his website and, what is this? And this explains so much. And so it started all these conversations that they had a gathering at a conference. When the then president of the board, Erling Hope, found out about what Caleb was doing, he says, well, y'all are doing what we were doing. And so they connected, in, you know, interpersonally. And from there, Erling was like, why don't y'all, like, step into this role? And so all of the, Caleb and his other colleagues at BU, actually, stepped into the role of taking over ARC. So Caleb became an ED. And all of those other scholars became part of the board. And so they have been operating that way since 2017. I joined the board in 2018. I was asked to step off to join staff in 2019, and I've been on in this role ever since. Well, I've been on staff ever since. I started the solo ED role in February. So Arts, Religion, and Culture is a community, is an organization that helps to facilitate connections, to give resources, to help platform and equip people who are at the intersections of arts, religion, and culture. That is not limited to Christianity. That's just arts, religion, and culture. And so we have people from spiritual leaders and believers from various faiths or spiritualities, lots of academics who are trying to think through how the arts, religion, and culture intersect, and also pastors, community activists, artists, people who find themselves at these intersections or at the in the conversations at these intersections that want to find each other and want to be able to share what it is that they are learning and gathering in community, to get support in community, and then to get equipped and platformed so that they can continue to spread the word of this conversation into the world. So that is kind of what we do. We do that through conferences, we have fellowships, we have awards, we have different programming and facilitation of conversations that we do. We are in a bit of a hiatus at the moment because somebody is writing her dissertation. But yeah, we are hoping to continue to build up and build out. So that's kind of where we are.
So the organization that you're the ED of is the Society for Arts, Religion.
Yes, that is our legal name, but our nickname is ARC.
I see.
Yes. Yeah, still the same organization. Yes and yes.
So, although this theopoetics is not a theology, and it is theology.
Yeah.
I can't, okay. Anyway, it seems to be liberative.
Mm-hmm. Liberation is
a liberative movement.
Yes.
Within theology, or within.
Yes. So, including Alves, several of the people who are a part of ARC would also consider themselves a part of Liberation Theology or Liberation Theologians. It's really hard to say you're about arts and not be about liberation and freedom. If you can't say those two things, and you're not about one of them, or both, right? I think that if we are talking about allowing the power of the art and embodied practices to enter us into new worlds, if those worlds are not about freedom, I don't want to go. Right? We're not doing anything but reinventing the world that we already have. And we're just not about that. I don't think anybody in this room is. And so I think that the concept of liberation, right? Liberation of the imagination, liberation of bodies, right? Liberation of communities, liberation of the land. When we think about the notion of freedom, you can't talk about freedom without the notion of play. think about those as like kinds of like resistance. So all of these different aspects and attributes are very much connected. So if you see or hear anybody talking about theopoetics and not talking about freedom, they're not a theopoet.
That was 90% of my question. But I'll take it one step further. I think if you require this mode of theology or thinking to accompany a liberation perspective, maybe my question is solved. But not all imagination, myth-making, music, right, art is good.
No.
In fact, incredibly complex mythologies are built around people I won't name, but you can imagine what I'm thinking about.
Right.
And what structures exist to make sure these tactics are not deployed for evil?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. That's a really good question. I was talking to, maybe it was Paul. Anyway, we're talking about evil geniuses, right? And how we always think about, wow, your ears were burning. I literally just said, wow. A little creepy, but I wrote it. We're talking about evil geniuses. We're talking about this very idea about the role of imagination. And as I am talking, I'm going to read you another quote from Alves, because Alves talks about this, about the role of control, and how control is not necessarily control with violence, but control with imagination and desire, and the way in which that works. I think we can learn a lot from evil geniuses, and I think people think I'm crazy for saying that, but the reality is, they're geniuses, and they understand the power of the imagination, right? Mm-hmm. And the power of how you utilize that within structures and systems, right? But to control. That sounds like a few former presidents. Now let me go over to find it. It is in my notes. In my Ruben Alves section on it. That is not that folder. This one. Okay. In the book Tomorrow's Child, which is his second, which is Alves' second book after the publication of his dissertation, and was written in, I think, 72, he says, "This is the pinnacle of the control of the imagination. Create so many objects of desire that the mind will be kept moving from one to another without ever being able to move beyond them." Continues, "The rationalization of control thus requires that the monopoly of violence is superseded by the monopoly of desire." And so the understanding that desire and the imagination has the power to dictate the trajectory of a person's life, what they will lean to, what they will buy, what they will believe, is how evil geniuses have controlled, right, the people. This is the media. This is, you know, certain ideas. This is the, remember that one case? And I think it was one of the Bushes. There are a lot of Bushes. And Willie Horton. You might remember Willie Horton?
Yeah, yeah.
And the way that he was utilized, Willie Horton was a black man in somewhere in America, I can't remember
Boston.
Exactly.
Boston.
Was Boston?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
That's right.
And what had been accused of something and was in jail and released.
He was paroled
by policy. Yes.
He was paroled under Dukakis when running for president, and Bush smeared Dukakis by race-baiting the whole country with using
Willie. Exactly, and using Willie Horton. And so when you think about the role and the power of story to not just to evoke fear, right, to persuade, right? So this is just one way. When you think about all of the ways in which everybody hates Facebook now because all of the advertisements, and like if you say something to your phone, it pops up and everybody's like freaked out. All of the sense of like media, marketing, all the way down to the sermons you preach in your churches, right? The fact that if you look at historical context of slave Bibles, there are a whole lot of books cut out that they didn't read because they didn't want them to find inspiration from certain books of the Bible that would provoke a revolt. Mm-hmm. They did anyway, but I'm just saying, you see what I mean? Because they understood the power of story and the imagination, evil geniuses have been using it for their evil genius enterprises for all the time. But so have communities of freedom and hope.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I think part of the church's problem is that we give away our imagination too quickly. Mm-hmm. Is that we don't understand the power. We do, but we don't. We are very comfortable in a certain way of knowing, right? Going back to epistemologies. That we can sit in, it's comfortable, maybe a little warm, may need a little, you know, reupholstering. But it's good enough. And that good enough has led us through traditions for years and years and years. Well, evil geniuses are probably some of the most innovative people you will ever meet.
Right.
I don't know if that really gets at your question,
no,
but hopefully it opens up to more conversation. Yes.
Thank you. I think sometimes in the same way, the Spirit of God can inbreak into society through images. For example, the neck of a black man. Think of the way we know those images of lynchings and how this death of Floyd brought that to the forefront because it was his neck.
Yeah.
And that's a memory, collective memory that we have versus all the other people that were just shot and killed by the police. That one image and the fact, and then a movement begins and things shift in the world. And that's a theopoetical moment.
Mm.
Oh, totally. I mean,
yeah.
We all watched that 8 minutes. What was it? 8 minutes? Mm-hmm.
8 minutes, 26 seconds?
Yeah, we all watched that.
I did not, I mean, I did not watch it because of the constant trauma, right? I turn away. I turn my computer off. I don't need to be reminded, but I know what you mean. Yes?
No, that was...
Yeah. But no, I think it's important to think through, right, the use of images, the use of media, right? This is what the Civil Rights Movement did, right? They utilized, right, the media to showcase the extreme violence being thrown at them, right, in juxtaposition to their nonviolence.
Right. Mm-hmm.
To where people could not deny, right? So that was super important, but that's also contextual. How old was television when that happened?
Yeah.
Now we have streaming and things and constant images and all of these different aspects of desire that we get so caught up in that so many people will see a shooting or a something by a police officer, say a prayer on Sunday if they mention it at all and say that's so sad and continue on with their lives. Or the people who even go out into, you know, the protests and they walk out and they do the things and they come home and they wipe their hands and I've gone out and this is good and I have my pictures and my hashtags. And we go right back, right? We go right back.
The evil ones use some of the video for their purposes too.
Exactly. Video, media, all of it. I'm not saying that media and images are neutral by any means. What I'm saying is that they have power.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand that power. Just like we understand the power of theology, right? It's a way of knowing. And if we are so caught up in being comfortable, right, in our own epistemologies, comfortable in what we think we can handle, we leave ourselves open. I'm going to get a little bit more to that in Octavia Butler has some really great insight for us in the parable sower that gets at this notion. And I think he's beeping, and I'm not exactly sure why. What time do we have? Okay, it's 2:30. Lost my clicker. Here it is. I know we talk about a lot of different things, but I wanted to see if there were any other things that you pulled out of as you're listening to all of these different definitions. What seems to resonate among all that you have heard?
For me, practices and embodiment.
Yes, very good.
That it's not just something you can kind of go, oh, I've got this. It's something you keep practicing. And I heard John Lewis in an interview saying that they practiced constantly how to respond to nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just like, oh, we can do this. They practiced.
Yeah.
And I really like that.
Yeah, practice and embodiment. That's good. What else?
Yes.
What I heard was for the sake of the community.
For the sake?
Simply the individual.
Yes.
If the individual at all.
Yes, for the sake of the community. That's good. That's good. What else? No one has. Yes.
To me, epistemology has been central, and the incredible importance of being aware of how we limit our capacities, our senses of knowing, and how we can expand them.
Yes, very good. Yes. Anything else?
Sensibilities of the divine.
Yes.
Not just what we think, but what we sense. Our sensibilities.
Yes, sensibilities. Very good. There was a question yesterday about methodology, and so I made a little slide about it. So, just to reiterate, this is a thing that I'm developing. There is no written methodology for theopoetics, so I made it up. Just as a reminder, methods, think of the methods of, are the ingredients of your research, the things, the tools that you are using to conduct and do the research. Your methodologies are the reasons for your research, the frameworks you're approaching. They are the why. Why are you doing the thing, right? I always talk about baking, right? When I bake cupcakes, I got my cupcake pan, I got my flour, I got this, I got, you know, all these different things, I got all these different ingredients. The why is because if I say I'm baking cupcakes and I put it in a bundt pan, I gotta come up with a compelling argument for why that is a cupcake, right? Right? If I'm using certain flours over other flours. I was telling Chelsea yesterday, I make gluten-free cupcakes. Well, why? Because if I wanted to make it formal, I would probably say, I want to acknowledge those on the margins of baking. So I really have the space to be centered and known and seen as they indulge in their, you know, right? I can see that. That's why I use gluten-free flour, because I want to acknowledge people who would not be able to partake of that. And that's important to me. Centering those culinary margins are important. So I'm going to use gluten-free flour, right? The flour is method. The reasoning, the framework, is methodology.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a sense. So this methodology has four movements. Movements are not steps. Movements are movements. Think of it as a dance. All of this is going to be kind of reoccurring, right? All of this is going to be present. The final two are probably going to happen later, but it's not like a rigid system because it wouldn't be geopolitics as it was. First one, social location. To situate the trace. A trace is not just a thing. It is also the reverberations and ripple effects, right? The effects that that thing has on our world. This term I learned from a friend of mine and my second advisor, Cutter Calloway, who talks about a trace as watching TV before everything was streamed, and you had to be there on that night at that time, otherwise you missed it. And if you missed it, the only thing you could do is either wait till reruns came on, or you could talk to your friends about what happened, right? Either at work or at school or what have you. And so what you are getting is not necessarily the actual TV show. You're getting the ripple effect, right? Somebody's like, oh, and this happened and so and so and so. But somebody who hated it was like, we'll give you a totally different account, right? Think about the ways that TV shows have changed our language, our style, right? The things that we say, the places that we go. Those are all reverberations, right? That is included in the trace. So, social location is to situate the trace in the researcher in a socially responsible way that considers the dynamic relationship that occurs between the two. So this is a meeting of worlds. So when I am studying Octavia Butler, right, what most people will do is they'll say, these are all the ways in which Octavia Butler is probably a Christian because these are all the things that I see in her work. That is bad research. Octavia Butler is not a Christian. She actually considers herself a former Baptist. And so when I am entering into her world, I am bringing a particular lens in the world, right? While knowing,
oh, okay, that's a little better.
Yeah. While knowing that the trace of the worlds that she has created reverberates in certain contexts, even though she has designated her actual artifact, the thing that she is providing, in a certain way. And so as the two worlds are meeting, I have to name and to understand those things and to understand what happens when those two things collide. So social location. You have to know how to socially locate yourself before you can truly move into these other steps. That's first. I said there were no order, but yeah, it is first. Secondly, radical inquiry. This comes from a book on A Guide to Methodology by some people whose name I can't remember right now. But they offer a four-step of radical inquiry, which I found really helpful for me, and so I adopted it into my methodology, or into my method. Radical looking, making the familiar strange. So making the things that you think you know what they are, strange. Troubling those waters. Understanding that because this is a meeting of two worlds, that there are ways that things are used that you are not used to using them as. And so how do you continue to investigate the strangeness, right, of what you see? You know how you like, I walked by that thing 50 times and I never noticed that? Whatever, whatever, whatever. Making the familiar strange. Second, radical listening, which is the critical noticing of voices within and around a topic. That includes voices that have been centered and heard, and also voices that have been not. So it requires an investigation of the voices that have spoken into the thing that you are investigating that have not been centered. That is very important. Radical reading, this follows that, which is a critical adaptation or rejection of existing knowledge. So as you are radically listening, right, as you are listening for voices that are not heard, that's going to have some kind of impact on the knowledge and the voices and the research around the thing that already exists. Right? Lastly, radical questioning, addressing the gaps in knowledge and how answers are morally and politically necessitated. All research is political. Just want to say that. Thirdly, something that we can all do and we do often is asking the God question. Two questions that you ask. First, what does God say about this? Meaning, what are the bearings of our tradition, our understandings about God, the sensibilities that we have so beautifully articulated? How does that bear on the thing that we are encountering? Maybe there's something in your tradition that says, you know, how you encounter television. I don't know, making it up, right? What has the tradition said on that? But also, the inverse of that, what does this say about God? So going back to theology as a semiotic system, as symbols, right? Then the things in the world can give us insight into who God is. Oftentimes, when we enter into some kind of like Christian research or theology, we do the first question and we don't do the second. Mm-hmm. We make figure out how the thing can be integrated into Christianity, into our traditions, or how we can make it a thing that's really about God, but we don't allow the thing to have voice, right? Mm-hmm. Mostly because a lot of times it's a voice of critique. We don't want to hear it, right? Or it's a voice that will cause us to expand our understanding and our epistemologies, and we don't want to hear it. And so we stop at trying to codify this within a certain Christian framework and say, this is what God says about this. It's usually, can you utilize it or not? Is it okay or not? Is it a yes or no? Can you engage it or can't you, right? Lastly, most importantly, responding artistically. If the thing that you are doing doesn't inspire creative, artistic practices and responses, I would argue it's not a theopoetic. If the teaching or the speaking or the artwork or the whatever, the way you're being in community doesn't inspire more people to do more of that thing, it doesn't count. And so this creates space of marginalized methods of interpretation and articulation of findings, and it creates practices and ways of living into research that is embodied, creative, and open to mystery. Mm. So this is everything from There's a book, Art Meets Method, which talks about how artistic practices are infused into certain methodologies. So when you think of like ethnographic fiction, things like that, that lives here. But it's also exactly what Mike did, right? It's also some of the things we'll talk about tomorrow, about how one of the women at the liturgies who had put away art project for decades, as a result of coming to the liturgies, took up painting more, right? It's this sense of it needs to spark something in the people who are experiencing it. And so that answers that methodological question. I know we have had tons of questions. We have 20 more minutes. So just to review, theopoetics is an emphasis, style, and positive concern. This is the ARC definition and the four methodologies. Questions? Any other questions? Oh, yes.
So this methodology, or
it's a method.
The method.
Yeah.
Is the method of engaging in theopoetics, or
it's a method
research?
Research. It's a method that I use for research. It's method, blah, 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 blah. I hate saying that word because when I try to parse it, it just comes out of blah, blah, blah. It's a methodology or a methodical framework that I use when I'm engaging in research. So when I'm approaching, say, the work of Octavia Butler, I am thinking about these things. And the other part about responding artistically is I'm not just looking for ways that it sparks art creative practices in me. I'm looking for things that already exist. So for example, Octavia's Brood. Octavia's Brood is a collection of short stories written by activists, right, who are writing science fiction in the vein of Octavia Butler about their issue. And they're not writers. They're activists. And so it is their way of responding artistically to Octavia's work and what it is inspired in them. That would be a fulfillment of that. And so I may not need to, huh?
And a trace,
right? So the responding artistically is also a part of that trace, exactly. And so I may not write a poem, I mean I have, but I may not write a poem, but the acknowledgement of something like Octavia's Brood as something that is important in understanding Octavia's world and its influences is something that I would consider in my research. Questions, other questions, other comments? Yes.
Could you say something about, I want to go back to the quotation that you read about desire. I think it was the Ruben Alves quote about that, the manipulation of desire and the evil that can happen with the manipulation of desire. Can you say a little bit about how theopoetics helps to reshape or reform desire or counter and I ask because it seems like the manipulation of desire, that quote was a marvelous quote about the extent to which it directs people's lives. So we're directed to desire. 2-year-old girls are directed to desire Barbies, bodies that look like Barbie dolls. We're directed to desire stuff that's creating climate change by producing all this stuff. So the redirection of desire is a powerful, powerful thing, and somehow it seems like the arts, artistic expression, have some capacities for redirecting desire that logical discourse doesn't necessarily have. In other words, I could critique logically the way desire is being manipulated and say we shouldn't go that way, but it doesn't have the power to shift desire. But maybe the arts and aesthetic expression does. So I'm just wondering about that.
Yeah, sounds like, I mean, you may have answered your own question, but I will add. Desire is something that we all have, right? So when people are manipulating it, they're doing it because everybody has certain desires. I mean, use the example of the Barbies and, you know, more and more Barbies and it's causing all this climate change, or more and more stuff is causing all this climate change. The question really is, okay, what are people really desiring? Like, what is it? It becomes a radical enterprise, and I mean radical as in roots, right? How do we understand the role and what is desired and what those things, right, the way it has been manipulated, has been fulfilled, right? We people want to feel accepted and beautiful and all of these notions, right? And so we manipulate desire by saying, to do that, you need to do this. But then we distract you and say, what you really want, plastic surgery. What you really want is this diet, or this clothing, or this look, or this thing. What you really want is to feel beautiful in who you are. But instead of doing the work of acknowledging, right, the that word that I can't think of right now, of beauty, right, acknowledging the presence of it in all people, instead, it's easier to control people if they all wanted to be a certain type of beautiful. We can market that, and we can create product for that, and we can, you see what I mean? And so I think theopoetics, just like it opens up a gateway to other ways of knowing, it opens up the gateway to say, what is it that we really desire? And to say, we don't have to only fulfill it in that way. I think arts are incredibly powerful in doing that. I would refer to the arts experts, one upstairs and one downstairs in this very room. I think Brian gave a really great demonstration on the notions of like how art can be used to think through some of those questions, right? Wow, what is art? What is desire? How do we think about these things? What do we really want, right? I think Maria is going to bring in some really great ways about embodied practices, right? About the ways in which artists have turned to using and engaging their art in a way that endears towards community and endears toward understanding the richness of our desire and the ways that we can fulfill that outside of ways that are bad for the environment or are utilized by the evil geniuses we talked about half an hour ago. Alves does a lot more of this work in Tomorrow's Child. My brain is a little fried, so I can't think of any particular quotes, but he does a lot with the notion of desire as a mode of play and freedom in that work, so I would commend that text to you.
And it's Freedom's Tomorrow's Child.
Tomorrow's Child.
Tomorrow's Child.
Other questions? Yes.
It's a comment I was going to have at the end. If anybody, two things. If you like the Facebook poll or the polls I did, you can go on my Facebook post. I've got like 6 years worth of a few hundred to if you want to look at. There's also stuff to scroll, other stuff too. Second, if you want to participate and give me three words, I've got pieces of paper here and a couple of pens, and you're welcome to do that. I have only one person left to write a poem for the rest of the week, so I've got time. And I love doing it.
Yes,
I
highly recommend it.
Somebody asked me if it was a blessing to them, I'm like, I just love doing it.
Yeah.
No, like you say, I mean, if you're motivated to do it, is it part of theopoetics? I guess I'm a theopoet.
So. You are.
Yeah. I don't know. I got enough stuff on my plate.
it's not meant to add to your plate. It's just meant to give you more words to help articulate who you are in our eternal. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So Willie Horton had been a white guy that they gave a second chance, a murderer, to get out on parole and then killed somebody. That wouldn't have touched off all this.
Wait, who said that again?
Willie Horton.
Yeah, if he was white.
If he was white.
Oh, yeah.
He wouldn't have had the touch to move all these things that go back to people's minds of, well, blacks are slaves, blacks need to be under control, da 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 da.
Right.
Just the raw nerve.
Yes, it situates a history of, what am I trying to say? It triggers reverberations of a history that this country has not yet dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
That has always been a story that has popped up and been navigated. So when you think about everything from birth of a nation, all the way through all, there is still certain words and context, right? He is a scary dude that if we let him out into society, see, look, he did the thing that we said he was gonna do, right? Birth of a Nation is this fear that black men want to rape white women, and that's why, you know, a black man looks at a white woman in a particular time in the South, even now, they are lynched,
Right. I think I have a quote from the campaign manager, I forgot his name, somebody might remember him. And he said, you know, it's an indirect way of say of talking about of peaking the racism as conscious in us. But we just don't say racism. We say William Morton instead.
Right. Because if we say racism, you'll have at least half the room going, I'm not racist. But if we say certain code words like law and order, everybody goes, oh, I can get behind that. Mm-hmm. But they don't understand that all of the racial implications that exist under those terms, right? All of the laws that have been enacted under for the sake of law and order, right? That have been completely racialized from the beginning, right? And it's just a tactic of words that people feel comfortable entering into. And they don't even realize what they're entering into. Some do, but you know what I mean. Okay, Susan, yes.
I would say, I don't know if you would agree, that the remake of Birth of a Nation, the Nat Turner story, was an act of theopoetics, possibly.
No. You know, yeah, because I think that Nat Turner's foundation of entering into that space was deeply theological.
Right, right.
He was a preacher.
Right.
Right? And then he started preaching in code, waved to the people, walked out the room and said, okay, now you know what the Bible says. Right?
Right.
And that fueled his anger. He saw his anger as a righteous anger, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about this in a class, Jesus, Church, and Violence, and it's actually centered on the story of Nat Turner and Weird John Brown. Mm-hmm. So, yes. Yes.
But would the original also be an act of theopoetics in a way?
No, because freedom. Theopoetics is about freedom, right? Freedom of peoples. And the original Birth of a Nation is not about freedom. The original Birth of a Nation is about fear and control, right? And subjugation, right? Through story. And so, again, when you think about the notion of story for the sake of subjecting people to a certain line for oppression, like that has been happening for all time, but I think so has theopoetics. So theopoetics has to be tied to freedom and liberation, which is what separates it from the evil geniuses. Yeah. Yes?
I love this evil genius name, so I'm going to go there again. And first of all, I should say, I work for a big internet general. So the idea of an evil genius to me is slightly complicated. It's actually hundreds of thousands of people contributing to an economy and an infrastructure that imposes this stuff on us. But there are evil geniuses too, for sure. I guess my question is about, was sparked by something you just said, the idea of freedom, liberty, as being kind of the standard by which we check whether this is a theopoetical enterprise or something else like a evil genius enterprise. Just listen to Trump people. The words out of their mouth are freedom.
Yes.
Liberty.
Right.
So I wonder if there's a layer under this. Whose liberty?
Yes.
For what purpose?
Yes.
And then you get into lots of difficult territory there,
I think that that's exactly right. And that's where you get into when we talk about like this sense of radical inquiry, right? Of the listening, right? Of the critical voices, right? Mm-hmm. You have to ask who is speaking and who is not. Mm-hmm. Who is present and who is not? When you think about the notion of freedom, on whose backs is that freedom being established? And now you get real complicated, right? And so I think that this is why the rigidity of it doesn't help us, because we can be satisfied enough to say, well, how's this thing? And for these people, let's give them liberation, yay. But you give any person liberation in America, which is necessary and required, you still have to deal with the concept of the stolen land of the indigenous people. And it gets real complicated real fast, right? We talk about this when we talk about why can't I think of it? Reparations, right? 40 acres and a mule, rightfully, right? Given to them before the whole Reconstruction, and the Jew took the word back, and they were like, our bad, and we were like, what?
right? Right before all of that happened. That was a really short history. But I mean, like, when you think about the concept of not just stolen land, but the concept of, you know, the notion that, you know, Africans were here exploring America way before any of this stuff happened, right? Before the Mayflower. You think about all these complexities of history and notions and land and ownership, right? It gets, freedom gets real complicated real fast. And so I think that you're absolutely right in asking who's freedom and who's liberty. I think that theopoetics is the place to ask those questions. It requires you to ask those questions. And then you have, I mean, kids, there's kids outside. Then you gotta sit in the stuff of it. You know what I wanna say.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you gotta ask where God is. Mm-hmm. That don't mean you get out of it. That don't mean you get out of this stuff. It just means that you're constantly asking where God is in the midst of it. And what does that mean for communal life?
And that's why the arts are not, have not been more prosperous in Christian circles, is because it puts you in the middle of it.
Yep.
Yep.
And it makes you stay there.
And it makes you have to attend to it, and people are uncomfortable. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Christians don't like to be uncomfortable, because Jesus already died on the cross. Mm-hmm. Jesus was uncomfortable for all of our uncomfortability for all time. So I don't have to have any uncomfortable conversations because Jesus was beaten and died for us.
It's like the ultimate passive aggression.
I mean, seriously, when we do that, Jesus paid it all. So I don't have to pay attention to any of the things that are actually happening in the world, right? Mm-hmm. That is the ethos of how we operate, because we think now we have this past. Yes and yes. I do want to say it's 2:55. Is ice cream today?
Nope.
No.
Okay, yeah, keep going. You are free to leave at any moment, at any time, but I do want to get these questions.
I'm curious about how we move from this notion of kind of passively not sitting in the muck,
mm-hmm.
right, to being able to constructively sit in the muck with the people we serve. So I'm a pastor, so like, how do I sit with people in the muck, even though they keep wanting to be in this passive state of Jesus died for all and forevermore, and so I don't have to deal with it. But like, we still have to deal with the muck, even our daily lives, and they're okay with dealing with that, but they don't want to deal with that at church.
So you confess without pardon. You hold pardon for a really long time. You sit in Lent for like a year.
Yeah. Like,
you
clothes,
you sit and you
and
right. You read only the Psalms where the psalmist is just going off on God, and that is the sermon. And you just kind of describe and elaborate on that, right? There are so many tools that already exist,
yeah.
right, within our tradition to help us do that.
Sure.
But we utilize that as check marks. This is why, and we were talking about this earlier, I forget who I'd be talking to about stuff, so forgive me, but we were talking about this earlier about the notion of you say the confession, then the person comes up and you receive the pardon, and then you move on to whatever the next thing in the liturgy
yeah.
is. And so we are inevitably thinking that we are teaching people to confess and then lean into the story of God's pardoning, but what we are teaching them is that that process is transactional.
Mm.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so liturgy then becomes a tool of play for us to begin to utilize and say, if I want my community to understand that lament is not something that you just do and then you sing a happy song on Easter Sunday.
Yeah.
Then I have the space to be able to play in a way that allows them to enter into that reality.
Well, yeah, and like even like the process of Advent and Lent,
right,
and then with the culmination of Christmas and Easter, like our liturgy, how we focus that becomes this exactly what the confession and pardon become.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a, I mean, we follow the subversive liturgy practice. We follow the liturgical calendar. Like, to that was just, you know, a thing, and I thought it was great, because I never
yeah.
followed, I didn't celebrate, I didn't know what Lent was until I got in the seminary.
also to know what like denominations were. Actually, side note, when I first heard about denominations and somebody explained them to me, my response to them was like, you know, I grew up in Long Beach and that sounds like gangs. Are denominations gangs? It sounds like it's just like a bunch of groups and everybody has their colors and they're arguing over territory that none of them own. And like there's all these like rivalries. And so, and she looked at me and goes, yes, denominations. And I was like, I understand. But I mean, do you see what I mean? Like I think that the rhythms that we established that is an example of a rhythm that we have established in a liturgical calendar is necessary. And I'm not saying that, you know, we can't celebrate, right? Celebration is a huge part of resistance, right?
Sure.
Dancing and joy and all of these things. You don't negate those things, you hold on to those things. Those are the things that give you hope, right? Those are the moments that still and have to exist even in the midst of all of this stuff. That's what James Howard Hill talked about, right? But we can get real comfortable in being able to dismiss those lamented moments for the sake of
the niceness of it all.
The veneer of celebration, right? Yes. And I think this is more relevant, honestly, in dominant cultures, in cultures of privilege. Because in certain Black communities and Black churches, like, you still celebrate all of those things. Like, people don't just stop dying on Christmas because it's Christmas, right? White supremacy doesn't go, is it Christmas? All right, we're going to give you guys this week because of the thing and stuff. And, you know, what day is it? Oh, I'm not going to shoot you or use a microaggression against you or fire you or say something for you or discriminate against you. Then take holidays. And so communities under oppression are still under oppression in the midst of their celebration. And so they have learned how to understand the notion of what lament means and what celebration means and how it operates and how it's codified within their communities. I think that because one of the privileges of privilege is this blissful ignorance, right? This normativity of those things are so distant from me that they affect me in the sense that I control how they affect me, right? Then the rhythms lose their power.
Yeah.
Because they become check marks, right? Instead of actual lived realities. When we think about the community of God, like I said to some random person here, I also can't remember, that, you know, the Gospels were first an oral tradition of an oppressed community.
Right.
Before they were written down to be the things that we, you know, live by and control with and all these other kind of things, right? Before they had the kind of power that we understand, right? The socio-political power that happened in Constantine. So I think that there are ways that we have to understand first the community that we're serving, right? And how certain things are operating within that community and what the needs of that community are. So then we can utilize liturgy as a tool of play to be able to allow people to enter into those worlds and to embody them and experience them differently. It is 3:02. If we don't have any other, I'm not talking to you. If we don't have any other questions, then yes. Oh, sorry, I forgot.
Reparations. I started thinking about the Japanese got $20,000. We went to a concentration camp, but then reparations becomes a real touchy thing for me as a white person because just from the Civil War. I've had, you know, six generations of my white ancestors who have each passed a house down or something. And then, you know, I can't give you reparations for 20,000. I need to give you probably half of what I own, $1 million or whatever.
I mean, probably more than half, if we're being honest. I think the complexities of reparations in America are just complex for all communities that are trying to work through them, including the Black community. I think that it, again, goes back to the history of negation and neglection of the realities of how this country was formed. When you think about the whole enterprise that was the Atlantic slave trade, right? And the ways in which America has become a global superpower because of that, right? then there's so many ties and the trace of the realities of slavery in America are so wide and deep that the reparations conversation, it makes it extremely complicated. And it also makes it complicated for people because the first thing that they will say is, well, I didn't do those things. Yeah. And you can't prove there's a direct linear lineage to that. The thing that I have right now has come from your ancestors doing that. Like, I'm not wearing a cotton shirt that was from the cotton, right? And so because people can't begin to enter into this big atrocity of the story, they go real small and say, unless you can prove there's a direct factual connection between what I have now and what happened then I can wipe my hands and say that I was not, that was not me.
But the Japanese, it was, we can not wipe our hands because that was our fathers or our grandfathers at least.
Right, it feels more, I mean, I can't speak to the histories of the internment camps and the reparations, so I don't want to misspeak, but I think that there is a notion of, there is a soft spot, to use the lowest of terms, as it relates to the ways white people particularly need to contend with the histories of slavery that are still happening, right? And it's insidiousness that is morphed throughout. If you want to know how that's happened, watch 13th.
Yeah.
13th by Ava DuVernay is, you'll see how that the system is still operating just in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is inescapable. And I think that for people who are opening their eyes to that, people will have, they don't know how to deal with the inescapability of racism in this country. We couldn't even begin to give enough. We can give everything and still
wouldn't be. A mule on 40 acres wouldn't do it because you should have had.
Well, a mule on 40 acres, I don't know how that translates now, but I mean, it's a start, like to being able, like generational wealth for a lot of black communities is impossible.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
And so the
10 generations that they had got the mule and the 40 acres.
Right, yeah, so it gets complicated real fast. But that would be an historian's question, and I am not a historian.
We have to get rid of redlining so they can own the property.
Right, so it's so complicated. But I'm sure that there are like several texts and things, and this battery is about to go dead, so we can charge it for the next person. But one more question? Did you have a question?
I have to talk about tonight.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we will look at some case studies and talk about some things, and I will be joined by Maria Fee. And then Friday we will talk about Octavia Butler.
Mm.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Ice cream tomorrow. There were neat brownies.
Yeah.
I mean, there is ice cream tonight.
There's ice cream tonight.
Yeah, but we can't. We were going to go as a class, right?
We're going to go as a class to have ice cream. Actually, is there ice cream on Friday in the afternoon?
No, it's Tuesday, Thursday in the afternoon, and then Monday, Wednesday, Friday after Vespers.
Okay, so tomorrow, let's do our presentations and do our showcase, and then we'll move out into that. We'll just dominate that patio and have conversation.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Cool.
Nothing like having a group of people talking about theopoetics dominating a space.
No liberation there. So, Brian, are you up there?
Yes.
Do we want to run through a fast run through of tonight, or what do you want to do?
Say that?
Do you want to do a fast run through for tonight, or?
Yes, I can totally do that.
Sure.
If we're all here, or
no, we're not. Where's Chastity and Cynthia?
Oh,
those are the two I actually need to talk to, because I talked to all of y'all already.
Okay,
we can just tell them what to read. I can, because it's going to be really long. I'll have Chastity do the confession. I'll do the opening piece. I'll have Chastity do the confession. Then I'll read the poem. We'll go into the song. We'll do prayers of the people, and then you all will read the poem and then the Irish blessing.
So the prayers of the
people,
prayers of
the
people,
refrain.
Right, has the refrain.
Yes.
So there'll be music under the prayers, right?
Yes, so you'll start playing when I start reciting the poem, and then the song, and then he will come up and read what the prayers are in the literature guide, in the leader guide, but you'll still be playing under.
Perfect.
Yes. And then I don't know what you have planned for the Irish blessing. Is there already a song for that?
Or? Yeah. Okay. No, it's just a
greeting. And now be our benediction.
Yeah.
And what you need for slides is up there.
What we need for slides is up there. You know what? I thought there was ice cream. I can come up real quick and show you and then come back down and stare at the wall.
Brian, do you need a printout of the prayers of people?
It's on the paper I gave you.
I have one.
Yeah, I'll print you out one if anybody needs it. I'll print out a master copy that won't have the highlights, and we can leave it at the podium since we'll be inside.
Okay, right.
Yeah, and then you'll just know which one you're doing. I'll just write your name by it.
Yes. Just replaced the battery just now, but I'll do it again.
Oh, that was great.
Yay!
Yeah.
You're a pro.
Mm-hmm.
You're very articulate and knowledgeable, and you can pull all the connections. You have a connecting gift, connect all the everything together, so that was awesome.
It cracks me up that you apologize for not, like, having the perfect quote at the one time, because so often you like have the perfect quote and it's just in your head and you have the sighting of where it's from. And I could never do that.
Yeah, it's like,
I could never do that.
I think it's also super helpful because I can admit so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be able to, when people ask you questions, it helps me make connections.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go upstairs real quick. Print out a leader's guide. We can look through it. We'll make sure everything's good. Print out a leader's guide. That'll be that. And then I'll let them know what slides are which. And then we're done. Did you send them lyrics?
I have not sent lyrics. So what I think is going to happen, what I think is probably easiest, is I will.